Hi, this is Dr. H at LifeWise, and you're listening to the Neuro Noodle Network podcast.
Thank you all for joining Neuro Noodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology podcast, featuring our neuropsychologists, Dr. Laura Janssen and Dr. Skip Wren. They've been practicing for over 50 years and are happy to share their knowledge with you. You can find Dr. Laura at janssens.com. Dr. Skip can be found at drskipwren.com. That's drskiphrn.com. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out. If they can't hear us, we can't help them. My name is Pete. Today we're going to chat with Dr. David Heflin of LifeWise, or Dr. H. One of the unique services of his practice is specializing in couples therapy using brain maps and neurofeedback. Doctor, thanks for coming on the show. Sorry I'm on the road. It's a little choppy out here, but thanks for coming on, Doc.
Yeah, thank you for the invite, Pete. I was excited to join you and the crew today.
Hey, tell us all about LifeWise. You guys are on the East Coast, right? How long have you had the practice, etc.?
Sure. So I started LifeWise in 2017 as a way to offer integrated and holistic approaches for my clients. And it was a way for me to sort of pull together all my interests in some of the psychotherapy and clinical training, but also bring in neurofeedback and biofeedback. And as most people that finish their postdoc at some point, they realize, why do I not just work for myself? And so that was kind of my journey a few years back, and I've been loving it ever since.
Now, how long have you been doing neurofeedback? How did you get started with it?
You know, it's an interesting timeline because I, in high school, so this is back in 2004 now, I became interested in this idea of like, if you could in a targeted way, go after the brain and repair it or fix it in some capacity, whatever fix it means, right? Then you could really alleviate probably most suffering. So I became interested in meditation and yoga and things of that nature that most people, you know, find at some point in their journey. But then at one point, my parents gave me a biofeedback machine. So in full disclosure, I grew up with two therapists and we could do a whole other podcast on that. But so they had gave me their biofeedback machine and I played around with the galvanic skin response measures and basic thermal temperature of your fingers and had a lot of fun with that. And then at some point I ran into someone that did neurofeedback and I thought, well, geez, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And I'll tell you, in 2006 or seven, I did my first training. I had just turned 21. And for those of you that know alpha theta training, it's part of the Penniston protocol and it's used a lot for substance use. It's also used for anxiety though as well. And so he did an anxiety training, he did an alpha theta training with me. And that night, it was like a month after I turned 21, I went out and I had no interest in drinking at the bar. And I remember ordering a soda and being like, there's something wrong with me. So long story short, I went to him the next session and I said, what did you do? That was insane. And he told me the science, walked me through it. And then I had a new addiction. Not that I was addicted before, but I had a new fascination and passion that grew in that week. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that's one of the side effects nobody really talks about is you lose, what do you say, Dr. Laura? You lose the taste for your drug of choice?
The research is behind alcohol for sure. And I've had the similar experience with patients, clients who baseball game and hit the bar afterwards with their buddy. And they kind of tell the same story. Like, I had no fun. Can you undo that? I'm like, well, no, let's talk about that.
Yeah, the one that I've heard before is, I don't really want to hang out with all my friends anymore. And we're like, whoa, yeah, we should talk about that.
I have had some teens who voluntarily quit smoking pot too. Yeah, interesting effect.
Maybe the bigger issue of just therapy singularly where it is addressed as maybe a personal choice or something like that, where you can just willpower your way out of it. And here we are, you know, talking around this idea of another intervention that just takes that off the table, right? Mm-hmm. People aren't going in saying, hey, I really have lost the taste for beer and I don't want to drink it anymore. It's like, hey, I'm doing this other thing. And now that's something that's just not appealing to me. It's quite a different shift, right? And I think that's what happens with neurofeedback a lot, I would say, right? It's beyond conscious drive. Anyway, I wish I'd had that at 21 or 18.
Well, I like to think of with neurofeedback or any intervention, really, you know, what need is it fulfilling? Or if you have a client that walks in your door, how are they fulfilling their needs or perceived needs? And how can the clinical interventions be a substitute for that? And I think with neurofeedback, we just have such an amazing way to get to the underlying structure where it's hard to talk yourself sometimes out of the need or craving of alcohol or whatever it is you're engaged in. So it's, you know, firsthand, it's been an amazing experience. And now I've had the pleasure of being in the field for a number of years now, not quite as experienced as the two colleagues I have sitting next to me on the Zoom screen here, but you know, I've had a pleasure of working with people and it's just been amazing to see that change played out time and time again.
Yeah, but you started earlier, David. We might be pretty close here. We don't even want to talk. We're not going to make a show about what we were doing in high school, right, Laura and Pete, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah, but nobody was doing that.
Thank God for no social media back then. When we talked in the pre-show, you were mentioning your work on concussions. Do you work with a lot of athletes? How do you use the EEG? How does that play a role in when you're dealing with somebody with concussions?
Sure. So, I mean, there's so much that goes into, you know, working with someone that has a TBI, so a concussion or traumatic brain injury or MTBI, mild traumatic brain injury. And, you know, I every client that I work with, I do a brain map on. And if I had my way, I would do that with every psychotherapy client and every couple that I work with as well. Now, you know, because it's not covered by insurance, it's not always available to people, but there's so much data you get from a brain map or just looking at, you know, EEG data that it really can be quite amazing and quite helpful. So in the case of concussions, you know, understanding where someone's brain is concussed and whether they have white matter damage or just a maybe mild ischemia, or if there's something in combination that's happening. So maybe they have a concussion and they're presenting with ADD, but it turns out that, well, actually the concussion was further back in their parietal lobe and it's causing sleep issues, which is then leading to lack of focus and brain fog because of their lack of the ability to, you know, to get restful, peaceful sleep in the evening. So there's so much data that comes from it. One of the interesting things about concussion is it's also very idiosyncratic. You know, so, you know, when you get someone with ADD or depression or some of these other kind of general protocols we have in the field, although, you know, everyone will tell you there's nuance to it, which is absolutely true. But with concussion, there's no standard. I mean, you have to figure out where did you hit your brain? How severe was it? What were the symptoms post-concussion? I mean, it really becomes a whole exploratory process in that sense.
Spring football just got done. Do you do a lot of work with football players?
So I've worked with some athletes in the past. It's, you know, I'm not up there with Leslie Sherlin or some of those folks that it's, you know, maybe more of their specialty, but I definitely work with more high school athletes, some college athletes. It's usually the people that, you know, they got knocked around on the field and they're trying to regain their scholastic aptitudes or their ability to study or, you know, work on memory or sleep or, you know, some of those sorts of things.
I know you said you didn't always get to do cues or scans before you meet with couples or individuals, but when you do, and I'm guessing the answer is yes, but I just want to hear your experience that you would do scans and then maybe come up with, hey, have you ever had a TBI? I find that we work with folks that aren't necessarily aware of it. There's a element of just banging your head around after a few decades where you're like, hey, maybe that wasn't a big deal, or you just don't stop and think about it, but it does have lingering effects. Do you find that and then introduce that into the therapy?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. The answer is yes. Yeah. And not just TBI, but all sorts of other conditions. You know, sleep is a great example of that. You know, I worked with a couple about a year ago now, where one spouse was, you know, presenting with ADD and was having trouble following through with scheduling dates and with his commitments to his partner. And, you know, after we did a brain map and we said, I was able to say, well, this isn't ADD. You're not sleeping at night. And once you start asking questions, they go, oh yeah, no, I wake up and I'm a bear in the morning in a bad way. You know, when you're able to identify that, it really changes the trajectory and then the quality of the work and, of course, the outcomes. And, you know, TBI is the same thing. You know, it's funny when you start talking to clients sometimes, and especially when you have the brain map data, you know, and you say, well, did you ever hit something? Did something ever hit the back of your head? And people go, oh, well, I fell down a staircase, you know, 5 years ago. You're like, well, yeah, that would be significant.
Right. With the therapy, and, you know, Laura's done it, I've done it, still do it maybe here and there. But just this idea, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is we've both kind of moved into neurofeedback and somewhat keep them separate. And it's just, it's really interesting to consider, but to talk to you about integrating that into the therapy. So when you're able to, right, insurance or just, you know, resources or whatever, what's that look like? You do a scan at the beginning of therapy, just like you would do an intake?
Yeah. So I actually have a number of clients that will do a brain map as their intake. And then they also fill out a questionnaire. I have a basic, you know, health form that I just need to know some background, what medications they're on and sleep quality relationships. So I do a biopsychosocial purpose intake. So I also look at meaning and purpose in someone's life as a measure of my process. And then combining that with the brain map can, you know, as we've talked about, gives me a lot of data. So when I go through the results with someone, I will write neurofeedback protocols that I recommend, but I will also talk about meditation recommendations, lifestyle, and therapeutic changes that I would recommend they consider as well. So for example, if someone's having poor sleep, we know neurofeedback is great for that. However, sleep hygiene would be very important to address as well, right? For somebody that is depressed, you know, you can see sometimes the clinical depression in the asymmetries or something else in their brain map. But then talking about meaning and purpose. So, you know, one thing I tell people is if you're working at a dead-end job that is eating your soul away, you could do 100 sessions of neurofeedback and really not get a whole lot of benefit. Whereas if we can change your environment, ideally in concert with other interventions, you're going to get maximum benefit. Maybe even a month later, you're going to feel like you're a whole other person, as opposed to, you know, trying to battle nature and nurture, you know, an environment with each other.
Do you actually hook them up, so to speak, in the session, or you recommend it as a side thing?
So I do, when I do neurofeedback with someone, I really combine a lot of the other, you know, processes. And I know we're going to talk about how that works with couples in a moment, but just with individuals, you know, when I have someone hooked up to the neurofeedback in the office, although at the moment I'm using MindLift systems as a home training option, there's some things I like about it. And of course, there's no substitution for a commercial system and having someone in the office, right? Mm-hmm. But when I have the opportunity to coach them live through that experience, I find it's much more powerful. So for example, I had a client that has a lot of anxiety and we were doing a PZ alpha training for him with his eyes closed. And he had a 10 second moment, you know, clip where his alpha was going up and his beta waves were coming down. And I paused it and I said, so how did you feel the last 10 seconds? And then we started talking about it. What did it feel like in your mind? What was in your body? Were you aware of anything you were doing to try to really magnify that? And, you know, I think of it like peak experience work, but applying that to neurofeedback training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I was trained by I don't know if you know her, but Dr. Lori Russell. She has a textbook that's used at STENS a lot. It's neurofeedback and neurotherapy. And she, in my mind, she kind of coined the term neurotherapy in terms of integrating psychotherapy and neurofeedback. And she uses it directly in the session. So she's having a cognitive behavioral individual session with somebody. And, you know, she's working through, thought distortions while the individual is connected to either biofeedback or the neurofeedback. And yet, exactly what you just said, kind of giving them direct intervention and feedback. And, you know, so if someone has a negative thought, you know, I don't know, I'm never going to amount to anything, whatever. And then to show them on the screen, hey, look what your brain does when you say that to yourself. Now let's rewire that thought restate it. And now look what the feedback, you know, look what your brain's doing right now. And so people can directly see the effects of changing their thinking and even, you know, saying things differently, restructuring. And that's kind of how it's done individually. Is So how was that? How would that work as a couple, or is that what you do in the couple session, or how does it work?
Yeah. So bridging that into couples is interesting. I will say, you know, just as a quick sort of foyer or side note into couples work, I had one client that is just enamored with neurofeedback, and she wanted to do this SMR training, the CZ SMR. And she called to mind four different guys she was dating while we were doing the training, and we watched her brain change. And I marked it each time she kind of had the image, and she actually picked the guy she was going to continue with off her online dating profile.
That's great. Yeah. That's great.
For any listeners that we have, that's very off script or off book for neurofeedback, but it was a fun experiment.
We'll find you a husband. Yeah. We'll screen your dates. Yeah.
Dr. Laura, can I ask a question? Sir. We're building that database of brains. Could that work in the dating world where you go in and get a brain map and find your mates, compare the QED?
Maybe that's where this is going. Yeah, we can screen people for dating. So, David, I don't know if you're listening to last time, but I'm a musician. Pete's a musician, and I have a lot of musician friends, professional, you know, very talented guitarists, not me, but my friends. And I've had them donate, so to speak, their brain pattern, their waves, their mapping. And so I was talking to a couple of the guests we've had in the past, and wondering if we can develop a database of professional guitarists. And so have people come in who want to improve their guitar skill and train their brain toward the professional's brain. You know, there's aspects that make someone a good guitarist. And so that's what we're thinking of doing. So we have two people in our database right now. You know, maybe some of this is tongue in cheek, but so Pete's got a good question though. You know, can you train people to be a better spouse, or can we develop maps to say, hey, here's a map of a good spouse, and we want to screen you? I mean, exactly what we're saying. Can we really screen people?
Sure. I mean, I did have a client that asked if I could do brain maps on all of her suitors and, you know, figure out who would be more compatible with her. I mean, I would say it's sort of anecdotal at this point. I don't know that there's a, you know, quantifiable data set, but it would be an interesting study as the end of your research grows, and to see if there is actually, it is an answer to that. You know, the way that I use brain mapping in particular with couples is to look at the harmonies. So if you have one client that's not sleeping well, and so they're grumpy, and then you have another client that truly has ADD and has no filter, well, then we can sort of start to guess how they're going to have conflict with each other, right? Especially in the morning. So I tell those clients, you know what, you should do your marital check-ins in the afternoon then. Don't try to do it in the morning. And then there's other ones, you know, if someone has trauma, right? Sometimes people aren't even aware that they have big T or little T traumas that really do impact their brain and thereby their life. And so help someone understand that can be really helpful as well. I also like to use brain maps as a way to normalize and give people perspective on what's going on inside them, you know, especially when you work with couples, but families in particular too. There's this like, you have to fix so-and-so, like they're the problem. And so if you can show someone, well, you know, this is what they have going on, and this is what you have going on, right? And so sometimes their issues might be louder, but it's only because the way that you're interpreting it or you're responding to it based on your neurology is amplifying that situation. And so it allows a little bit more ownership towards a solution from both parties, I find.
That's a great tool. Yeah, I've done tons of couple therapy as well. And yeah, you're always going like this, like, yeah, put the mirror in front of yourself, and it's hard for people to own their stuff. So that's a great tool.
It is a great tool. How do you rate folks' receptiveness to that? Because it's, you know, it's pretty clear. It's literally a picture. Here's what your brain's doing. And, you know, not to throw anybody under the bus, we're talking about hypothetical folks anyway, but, you know, someone says, hey, it's this issue, and if we fix that issue, then everything's fine. And you're like, well, you know, there's a little more to it than that. So are folks receptive to it? I would think they would be if they're in your office, but, you know, try not to assume.
You know, there's always going to be people that are, you know, not receptive or want to point fingers. And, you know, they're the ones that don't last in the therapy typically, right? But the people that are open-minded to that process, I think, are able to mine it for valuable information. You know, it's the same way in most couple sessions where you say, okay, the presenting issue is that this spouse yells, right? So you could easily say, well, they're the problem or the yelling is the issue. You know, but we know that there's something leading up to that. You know, they're not feeling heard, you're triggering old traumas. They're frustrated with repetitive patterns in the dynamic of the relationship, you know, whatever it is. What I try to do is get both spouses to understand their role in that dynamic and understand then how to start stepping out of that. You know, the line that I use with couples is most couples are stuck in negative circles. But the great thing about a circle is if you break it anywhere, it's no longer a circle. So with neurofeedback or psychotherapy or whatever the technique is, I can give people 100 places and you just have to make one of them work.
Great. Yeah. And you talk about yelling. I mean, you know, anger management on both sides of things, you know, anger management has to do with people who are yelling, but it also has to do with people who are passive, right? So I'm sure there's all sorts of techniques that you can intervene with on both sides of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, if someone's emotional overload is to shut down, right, because you can explode or you can implode, so to speak, then if they're tending to shut down, sometimes you can see those correlates in a brain map. You know, someone with trauma is probably going to be more resistant or not. Well, they could go either direction, I suppose, not probably resistant. But so someone with more trauma could easily just shut down to avoid the conflict, whereas, you know, someone that has a really fast processing speed or PDR might tend to just start revving up and ramp up. And then they're often yelling or whatever they're doing before they have a chance to hit the brakes or pull in the reins.
So practically, what do sessions look like time-wise and all that? You know, the psychotherapy, I think I can wrap my head around, and neurofeedback, I can wrap my head around those sessions. But then you combine it, does it change the structure, the timing, the frequency, any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the nice features of doing home training is people do have the option of doing their neurofeedback outside of sessions as well. And then I can use my time with them to, you know, review data or do a live training and coach them, or sometimes just say, you know what, you know, keep the neurofeedback for what you're doing at home and let's focus on the therapeutic, you know, the core values or finding their meaning or communication skills or, you know, other things outside of neurofeedback training. You know, when it comes to couples, I have found that there's a number of different ways to integrate neurofeedback, and it seems to work best with people that are already making progress. You know, if there's a couple that's working through a really intense trauma in their relationship, trying to get them to sit down and do neurofeedback together is probably not the right approach, that they either need to do some individual, you know, neurofeedback or work through it together through the communication. But if they've learned how to communicate, they have a good foundation in the therapy, then I have found bringing in neurofeedback can be really helpful for the two of them. And there's some body of research on interpersonal biofeedback, I believe is the term, where they're doing heart rate variability training or respiration, you know, biofeedback with a couple. And it, you know, that's, although that is somewhat popular, as far as you can say biofeedback is popular, you know, neurofeedback seems to be the next evolution of that step.
I know we've been focusing on couples therapy. I feel compelled to say this, my relationship's fine. So my questions aren't driven by any personal interest, just to put that out there. It's purely professional.
Are you going to ask it about a friend of yours that has a
question? Yeah, exactly. But I know you do other things too. This is fascinating, I think. And the idea, the bigger idea, and certainly not to minimize anything you're doing, David, but what we seem to keep hearing as we talk to more and more providers out there is a holistic or integrated approach to what's being done in offices. And sure, our you know, podcast is about neurofeedback and neuropsychology, which is maybe a wider net there, but there's more aspects to it. It's not just coming in and hooking up to electrodes or, you know, getting a medication or doing therapy. It's, you know, so many other aspects. And then you take it into how folks actually live their lives outside of the 1 hour they meet with you or whatever that, you know, period of time is. I'm been reading on and off for sure some of the Urban Monk books, and it's, he doesn't really promote neurofeedback, but it's this approach of, hey, let's look at lifestyle, like you're saying, and let's, you know, with your intake, which is sounds pretty comprehensive, but biopsychosocial meaning intake, that's so far beyond, hey, what's your date of birth and social, and what are your presenting problems, and it's, wow, like we're talking about all of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, the systems theory, you know, systems, micro and macro, is what's missing from a lot of psychotherapy, and even missing from neurofeedback. You know, this hit home for me when I was doing training. I was a technician in an office for about 3.5 years, just putting electrodes on someone's head. And I remember there was this elderly woman that I don't know how many sessions she did. It was a few months and nothing was changing. And we were like banging our heads against the wall, trying to figure this out. And then one day she casually mentioned her noisy neighbor. And we said, well, tell us about the noisy neighbor. And, you know, this person was playing electric guitar at 3 a.m. and our identified patient's primary complaints were, you know, frustration, anxiety, depression, sleep issues, brain fog. And meanwhile, this obvious wrench in her system, her home living situation, had never been brought up. So, you know, that to me just, I carried that memory through the rest of my training because I realized how important asking some of those questions and getting the holistic big picture of someone's life really is.
With playing guitar at 3 a.m., what are you talking about?
That's why you have a basement studio, right? Not to keep harping on therapy, but it is our base training, right? And not even that long ago, I know you were more recent, David, but, you know, for Laura and I, we're talking the 90s, and again, you know, you can add up the years, but it's not that long ago where there was still a pretty singular focus on treatment. Hey, here's your stuff. We're talking about it. Institution that I trained was, you know, kind of psychodynamic oriented, which is more along these lines of an individual, right? And then looking at it that way. And it just seems like it's evolving more and more. Maybe it's the guests we're having or, you know, what's out there, but it just seems like everything is loosening on the edges and opening up to, hey, let's consider a lot of these things that are impacting actually how you're functioning. And I mean, beyond conscious control, of course, but other things too, right? EMFs, right? Toxins in the environment that mess up your gut. And then now your gut's not working healthy and you got a leaky gut and it's infecting how your brain functions. Those things are observable now, right? Through technological advances. We see them through the EEGs, but not, you know, directly, but you're seeing functioning. And so what's leading to that functioning? And it's just such a wide open question that I think allows for approaches like you're describing for us, but also, you know, indirectly, and maybe it's not indirectly, maybe it's intentional. It seems to take the heat off the individual. It's like, hey, you're not being a jackass. You might be, we can certainly say your behaviors aren't okay, but what's leading to them? It's not, you know, I'm waking up today wanting to be surly and bitter and this or that, or anxious or, you know, depressed, whatever it might be. It's that, hey, there's other things driving your experience. So let's try to get after them. And it's, again, I'm really encouraged by how much airplay, no pun intended, this is getting. And I mean, in, you know, conventional sources, right? Like the APA monitor that comes out monthly, it's talking about this stuff all the time. And it wasn't a handful of years ago. I think it's cool. I think it's great.
It's amazing how exponentially the change towards systems and looking at holistic care and all this has come. And there's a quote that I'm going to misquote the exact words. So maybe we can find it later and put it in the comments or something. But it's something like, your symptoms are not your problem, but your wellness is your responsibility.
Good one. Yeah.
Your symptoms are not your fault, but your wellness is your responsibility, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I like the way that couches the situation. And like you said, Skip, it acknowledges that, you know, you are kind of on this journey and there's lots of factors for the way that you are, how you are, even if you're angry or you're an alcoholic or you have other addictions or you can't sleep or whatever it is. But the way you move through that is something that is all of our responsibilities to figure that out.
Hey, David, how's business through the pandemic? How are you getting by, and what are you seeing with the families?
Yeah,
5 minutes.
I mean, that's on everyone's mind right now, right? I mean, my practice in February of 2020 was about 90% neurofeedback. And then you fast forward to the second week of March in the Boston area, and I rewrote my entire website in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, I do probably 20% of my caseload at the moment is neurofeedback training. And unfortunately, it's hard to do the couples neurofeedback with some of the home systems. It's more of kind of a theoretical approach at this point until we can resume in-office visits. Mm-hmm. But I have been doing a lot more couples work. You know, the one of the things that I said early in the pandemic to the couples that I was working with is, when was the last time you spent more than 4 hours apart from your spouse or your family? Because, I mean, if you strand any 2 to 6 people on a desert island for a year, there's going to be conflict.
Hey, guys, a couple things, and you can hit these. We haven't trashed DSM yet. And then number two, with COVID, and are the schools prepared to deal with the special ed needs for all the kids that are coming back? What's it like on the East Coast, Dr. H?
You know, East Coast is a broad region. I would say in New England, even New England's a broad region. I mean, there are, you walk around and there are people that are taking the guidelines seriously, masking up. There are, you know, my wife and myself have been to indoor dining facilities off peak hours. Although you can make an argument that right now every hour is an off-peak hour. And at the same time, you know, I have clients that, you know, I work with someone who identifies as an alcoholic, and I say, where are you drinking? And he goes, oh, I go to New Hampshire. So, you know, some states really are more lax on that. And it's interesting. I think it'll be interesting once we actually have numbers and research to see where are more cases popping up, especially with the vaccines. How many people are getting vaccines? You know, when I logged in to get my vaccine for my wife and I, our first dose of Pfizer, there were 57,000 people ahead of me on this electronic line. Whereas, you know, you read articles about other states where they can't even fill the slots they have. So it's all over the map, I think, in a lot of places.
We've been talking about couples a lot, but do you work with kids?
My wife is the child and parental part of the LifeWise franchise,
okay.
Franchise of one office. And so she works a lot with parenting, works a lot with kids. I have 2 kids and I love my kids. I find that it's doing kids and systems work with families is just something that I don't feel equipped to do oftentimes. I like working with adolescents and adults and couples and the relationship and marriage. And I love the trickle down that we see from that work. But specifically with kids, I refer to my wife for that.
Mm-hmm. I've read somewhere, and that's all I can say. I've read somewhere that there is a procedure where you connect the individuals together. Like you hook up the neurofeedback somehow where they're kind of operating in sync. And maybe to your point about finding the same rhythm. Have you heard anything like that?
Yeah, so I've done a few of those trainings with couples. I know there's an intern that I used to have in my office who one of his goals was to do that in the corporate setting and have, like, you know, 5 or 6 board members all get hooked up to one system. As far mm-hmm. as I know, that never came to fruition, but I think it's an interesting idea. You know, when I've done that with couples, which you could kind of apply this concept to other groups of 2 or more, it seems like there's a couple ways to go about it. So you can have a common goal. So let's just take PZ alpha training or alpha theta training. You know, if everybody is meeting that goal, then there's a common reward in place, a global reward, if you will. Or you could have multiple notes of a single chord that, you know, go up in volume so that you're trying to get a harmony with everybody. Mm-hmm. I have found that to be difficult because, you know, for anyone that's familiar with group projects in college, sometimes 1 or 2 people are carrying the weight. So I have found that, you know, with couples that are really in different places neurologically, sometimes they feel like they're doing all the work and then you get a lot of parallel process to the relationship.
So you have to do a lot of background work first, get them closer to the same page. Yeah, I think about that, like just having couples, you know, just sit and look at each other and do mindfulness or something like that with each other. That it's cut the tension with a chainsaw.
Yeah. So I have found that trying to give a couple individual goals to work on and then to meet that. So when couples have individual goals they're working on in neurofeedback, and you can give them a chance to celebrate their individual successes together, that seems to produce better outcomes. So for example, one person might be working on a frontal training, someone else is working on a parietal training, but when each of them is successful in their individual goals, then there's some global feedback that they receive.
Especially when they stop drinking, right?
Right. Well, and it seems to also mimic just couples therapy and life in general, right? It's not like we're always doing exactly what our spouse is doing, but we have individual goals that are for a greater synergy together. So that intuitively seems to make sense to the couples that have tried this sort of couples neurofeedback. And it also seems to play out in the actual session.
Can you speak to neuromeditation and just what that is for you guys? And just real quick, Laura and I have had conversations before. Obviously, you know, meditation is considered helpful, and that's probably a gross understatement. But we've had conversations about, hey, like not all brains are set up to meditate as well as other brains. And I know you're not supposed to keep score in meditation, but I think you know what I mean. And so when you're talking about neuromeditation, I'm thinking along those lines that, you know, sometimes folks have excess chatter. That's an understatement too, right? Where it's really challenging and maybe, you know, ancillarily, if that's even a word, when they're done meditating, they don't feel better, right? They're like, man, I just did this for 20 minutes and I got my grocery list done. That was about it, or whatever. So can you answer that if you can find a question in there? But then also the main question is, hey, what is this neuromeditation that you're doing?
To use one of my couple's communication skills and mirror you, it sounds like you're wondering about neuromeditation in the sense of how do you try to match that to individual goals, since it's not a one size fits all experience.
For sure. And then what is it in and of itself, right? Are people hooked up while they're meditating?
You know, my initial training in neuromeditation, and the guy that I'm aware of that coined that term is Dr. Jeff Tarrant in Oregon. And he would be a great person to have on your podcast if you reach out to him at some point. He and I differ in our approach slightly. So I'll tell you how I do it. And then he can always claim to do it his way. Or he will talk about doing it his way. The way that I approach neuromeditation is to do a brain map first. So we know that not every brain is the same, and not every meditation style produces the same outcomes in someone's brain. So for example, you might find that there's a frontal slowing that's maybe OCD related or ADD or something going on in the anterior cingulate. And doing a focused meditation to train that ACC and that saliency network can wake up that person's brain, give them a sense of clarity, lift them from a fog. Now, other people might have trouble staying in the moment or being present, and maybe their processing speed is too fast. We need to slow their PDR a little bit. So in that case, alpha, low alpha or even alpha theta states are more associated with sensory experiences and having this in or out of body experience, depending on how deep you go with it. And so I would do mindfulness, body scanning, maybe a little bit of quieting their mind as well, depending on how well they can access that state. And so I think that answers your question about kind of how I approach it based on individual characteristics. The actual session itself is how I run a lot of my neurofeedback sessions. And basically hooking someone up to the electrodes and then starting the protocol and then noticing when they get into a particular state or when they're edging towards that state, and to pause them and say, hey, the last 15 seconds, you've been heading in a great direction. What did you notice? Did you feel like you were in the right place? And sometimes people will say, you know what, that felt really uncomfortable actually. Okay, great. So we probably need to pick a different meditation style for whatever the reasons might be.
And what, just to be explicit, what is your intention behind asking those kinds of questions?
So part of it is to give a level of an internal locus of control. I find that, you know, a lot of people that do neurofeedback feel like they're outsourcing their wellness to this machine sitting on a table. And I want to point out that it's like, no, you're the one doing the work. I'm like a musical tuner and you're playing the chords, you know? So I want them to really own their experience. I also want to make sure that we're defining success and really magnifying that experience. So if somebody is thinking of their loved one during a loving kindness meditation, to be able to identify that in the sense of like peak experience and positive psychology and to saturate in it, to use some of Rick Hansen's work, and teach them when you are feeling down and depressed, calling up a picture of your grandma seems to neurologically and fundamentally change your experience. So let's use that as a tool 24/7, not just 55 minutes a week.
I'm gonna give you 5 minutes to bash the DSM. Go.
All right, let's ask David a question though, so he'll do it effectively. So folks come in with, you know, diagnostic labeling because that's how it's set up, right? Hey, I've got depression, I have anxiety, or whatever it might be. How do you field that type of presentation? What do you do from your, you know, treatment perspective?
I mean, this comes up a lot in, I think, the world of neurofeedback, because brain waves do not necessarily fit into these neat categories. You could even make the argument that symptoms do not fit into neat categories, which is what the DSM is largely organized around. So, you know, when people come in with their diagnostic labels, I usually tell them, I'm interested in your experience. I'm really not interested in the label so much. A great example of this is borderline. We know that most people that have a diagnosis of borderline have some sort of trauma and often developmental trauma. And my issue with calling someone borderline, kind of like what we talked about earlier, is it puts the onus, the label, the problem on the individual. You know, and it reminds me of, to pick another example, I have a client that is a heavy drug user. I said, you know, once you understand her family and what she's been through with her family experience, you go, shoot, that's all you've used? Like, I totally understand why you want to numb yourself out every day based on your experience. To wrap up in my perspective of the DSM, I think it's too individually focused and it needs a broader holistic perspective.
Agreed.
I think the doctors agree on that one. Dr. H, Dr. Helfand, what's the best way for our listeners to find out more about you? Is that lifewisevt.com?
Yeah, going through the website's the easiest way to learn about my services and contact me. I send out a hypothetical monthly newsletter. Sometimes it's a semi-monthly newsletter or bi-monthly newsletter. There's a lot of information on the website. I always offer a free phone consultation for people that want to work with me so I can make sure that we both feel like it's a good fit. We can interview each other. And, you know, I also have a network of other people because it takes a village. So if someone comes in with IBS and I think that it's not neurofeedback and psychological work, but they need to go talk to a nutritionist, I try to kind of funnel within my network and get them the help that they need.
Sorry for the hard listen out there, guys. Traveling up to Wisconsin right now, we couldn't miss our time. So it's better to have a crappy listen than no listen at all. Guys, Dr. Laura can be found at Janssons.com, JanSons.com. Dr. Skip can be found at DrSkipRin.com. That's DrSkipHRIN.com. Ideas for a topic, please email me, Pete@NeuroNoodle.com. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter. Guys, if nobody's listening, nobody's getting help. Thank you so much. Cue the non-copyrighted music.